Hello and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. This week we speak to JP Morgan's Chief Market Strategist, Karen Ward. Topics cover global growth, global trade, Fed policy, Chinese policy, and of course, Brexit. And on that thread, here is our guest's assessment of the UK's current predicament.
You know, my six-year-old said to me, "What is Brexit?" And I said, "Well, basically, we used to be best friends with Europe, and now we're trying to decide whether we never want to speak to them again or still play with them at lunchtime."
Okay, for more insight into this analogy and the other topics mentioned in a really fascinating conversation, please keep listening. First, however, come some important disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director at Brewin Dolphin. And today we're going to have sort of a macroeconomic conversation, an investment strategy conversation with Karen Ward, the Chief Market Strategist over at JP Morgan Asset Management. Karen, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Pleasure, very well, thank you.
Good, good. Well, it's your debut on this podcast, so we'll do our best to be sort of gentle. But I think in terms of the conversation, I think we're going to look at sort of the major issues that are plaguing markets at the moment, whether it's have the Fed communicated too much dovish action, what type of stimulus are we going to get out of China and its impact. And I note from your CV, you are former chair of the Council of Economic Advisers to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, so we can't avoid the Brexit conversation. We won't go there first because that's sort of a bit of a rabbit hole you can't get out of. So let's start with the US. Be really interested to know what your take is on the sort of growth conditions there, evidence of a slowdown, but some good jobs numbers last week, and what this means for Fed policy. Clearly, the bond market's got is very excited about the thought of sort of two or three rate cuts over the coming 12 months. So with that backdrop, Karen, how are you seeing the US currently?
Well, I think the US was always going to slow significantly this year. Last year, the 3% growth numbers that we saw were largely attributable to the vast range of tax cuts that President Trump enacted when he first took office. So that gave you about a percentage point of growth. So our view was always we were going to see the economy slow from 3% growth rates to about 2% by the end of this year. Then I think there's a question of how the trade conflict actually starts to impact the US economy and maybe compound that slowdown. And I think we have seen some impact within the manufacturing sector, as we've seen globally. Companies, it looks like they are stopped investing. They've really slowed down their CapEx plans, and that's led to this industrial slowdown. At the moment, it only looks like a slowdown. It doesn't look like it's going to be much worse than that. I think what we are mindful of, or certainly concerned about, is whether that corporate behaviour turns from not just slowing CapEx, but actually starting to think about some job cuts. If we were in that world, then I think we'd be much more concerned about a more material slowdown. But we've just had a payrolls report that was still robust. Most of the business surveys suggest there's still job creation. So I think at this stage, we are just looking at a moderation in growth rather than anything more material. And of course, you know, the Fed, with that backdrop, are saying, well, our starting point was inflation was on the low side. Now the economy is moderating. We've got to help keep things moving. And clearly they're under a lot of political pressure as well to do so. So I think absolutely right and justified on their mandate, they're going to take rates down a bit. They'll probably go in July, again in Q4, 25 basis points in each of those meetings. And then, as I say, whether that turns out to be a little bit of preemptive insurance, which just keeps everything ticking along, time will tell. And I think largely does depend on the politics. If we don't see any further escalation in the trade war, then I think this will just be a couple of rate cuts, the US moderating. However, I think if we see the trade war ramped up further, we see an extra round of tariffs, a final 25% put on the full range of Chinese imports, then I would get much more concerned that this is actually going to be a material slowdown and we're into a full Fed easing cycle. But at the moment, as I say, just a moderation rather than anything more worrying, I suspect.
The trade conflict is obviously a very challenging one to predict, but more broadly, what are we seeing in the US economy? You talked about sort of the CapEx slowdown. I mean, is there any evidence elsewhere of sort of a bottoming out in, or a troughing in this slowdown? I mean, we think about bond yields that have moved much lower. That's sort of a stimulus in itself. Is there any evidence outside of this sort of trade noise that the US economy is maybe set to reaccelerate?
Not obviously set to reaccelerate. As I say, the 3% numbers we saw last year were largely tax cuts.
Yeah.
I think to believe we were going to reaccelerate, we'd have to be suspecting there was going to be a big infrastructure package coming, which we don't think that there will be appetite across both the Democrats and the Republicans at this stage to put that through. So no, I think the hurdle to reacceleration is pretty high. But my experience is investors aren't so much worried about reacceleration. They know this has been a long expansion. The big worry is that actually the whole thing has timed out and we're looking at the prospects of a recession. I don't think that's the case. I do think this is going to be just a moderation. And as you say, falling bond yields, falling mortgage rates, that should help the housing market kind of tick along. But I think at best, we're looking at a moderation and re-acceleration would be really hard to come by.
Okay, and then just on the trade conflict, I mean, clearly there's a very clear argument that if it were to sort of re-escalate, that not only would the global economy take some fright from that, but markets would too. But we had a colleague of yours, Richard Titherington, on earlier in the year. And, sort of in this, we're sort of thinking about this sort of perverse outcome that if we do get a material escalation in the trade conflict, that China sort of rides to the rescue with a big thumping stimulus. I mean, do you have some sympathy with that view, or would you be much more nervous about what trade tensions could do for the global economy?
I certainly think that China has the ability and willingness to fight back with domestic policy. So I think if we did see a further escalation, we would see the stimulus measures ramped up. At the moment, they are hesitant. They're still worried about debt levels. It's been more incremental. It's been very targeted, the easing. And it certainly hasn't been sort of broad-based flooding the economy with credit in the way that we've seen in past stimulus. This is more about tax cuts and trying to get consumers spending. But I think they have, as I say, the ability and willingness to maintain growth above 6%. So I think China would actually, even if they're in the eye of the storm, would weather it relatively well. I'm more worried about the impact it would have on Europe, because I think Europe is very much caught in the crossfire. Europe is increasingly heavily dependent, not just on China, but broader emerging markets. And I think we've already seen over the course of the last year that Europe is still a region heavily dependent on exports, heavily dependent on capital goods exports and capital and global capital spending. And therefore, if we're in a sort of trade escalation, then I think it would be Europe that's most badly affected. So I do think it would have global ramifications. I also think it would come back to bite growth in the US and perversely, it could actually be China that continues, growth better than elsewhere, even though they are the target of the action.
I mean, we're sort of trying to sort of square why markets have been so strong. And, you do have this sort of thesis that there are sort of three puts or three forms of insurance that come in the form of sort of Donald Trump. But, if trade tensions get so much, the markets react, he'll get back around the negotiating table. We talked about the Fed and their willingness to ease, and this sort of China stimulus package. And I always sort of feel like the go-to answer in investment is, yes, volatility is likely to prevail. But, you know, should we be really accepting the volatility? Do you think we should still be sort of leaning into stock markets despite these trade challenges because of those three insurance elements and any others that you may sort of call upon?
So I have a bit more belief in a couple of them. So I think the trumpet, as you described it, that it must be true that he's walking this delicate balancing act between wanting to keep the trade agenda and the America First, more aggressive political agenda alive in the run up to the election. So he that hostility, I think, is serving him very well amongst his base. At the same time, he doesn't want to go so heavy handed that he puts his own economy in recession. He's made quite clear his campaign is keep America great. It's about that strong economy, strong labor market. So you assume not only just via him wanting a higher stock market, but him wanting a strong jobs market, that would restrain where he goes. I think that sounds a sensible put. I also think that, as we've said, the China stimulus would be ramped up if required. I'm a little bit less convinced that the Fed slashing rates would be enough to mean the outlook for corporate earnings is fine. We've seen in former downturns that no matter if the vicious cycle has taken force and people are worried about the future, worried about job losses, and they stop spending, there's very little the Fed can do to stop that sort of recessionary loop. So I'm less convinced that we should be totally reassured by the fact the Fed is willing to cut rates. But the other two, to some degree, in terms of broadly what we do with this as strategists, I think de-risking aggressively probably isn't going to serve us terribly well. I think, not only does it seem that it's not in President Trump's political interest to ramp things up too aggressively, but the underlying dynamics of the economy still look pretty good. There's no inflation anywhere. There's very little sign broadly of excess. So it's not obvious that the cycle itself has reached its limits. So I think it's really about staying exposed to risk assets, but starting to think about some of these tail risks, if we do get some of those political judgments wrong, and what in your portfolio is really going to work to offset some downside that's happening in your risk assets. So the role of treasuries, for example, yes, it's true that bond yields have already fallen a long way, but if we got into a severe downturn, then I think we would see treasury yields reach a new low. And there's still considerable upside that you would get from US treasuries
I would agree with that. I mean, you do often hear that in the press, commentators say bonds have lost their diversification qualities. I mean, there's certainly some outcomes where bonds don't do well, but the recessionary one, I think we'd echo your comments that there is still returns to be had from these optically expensive looking assets.
Yeah, exactly. I think the uncomfortable thing for investors is, whereas in former late cycle episodes, you could easily transition into core government bonds and earn a decent yield while you were waiting for a problem.
Yeah.
So you not only had that insurance factor, you earned a decent yield on them because the central banks had normalized. We're clearly not in that world anymore. So they're a little bit painful while you sit there in the interim, because in real terms, you're not getting a lot. In Europe, you're obviously you're paying a lot for that insurance. But at the same time, they do have still that insurance property of rising significantly in a recession, as you say. So I think that's one. Otherwise, thinking about macro funds, they tend to be able to, more nimbly use derivatives and move across asset class to cope with volatility better. And then maybe thinking in the alternative space about whether there are diversifiers there that not only can work in opposite directions, or at least hold their value in a stock market decline, but maybe, unlike government bonds, as we were saying, they have some income properties, as long as, of course, you can cope with that illiquidity in the interim. So I think that's the real challenge for us as strategists at the moment, is just making sure we're not too focused on the most likely scenario, thinking hard about these tail risks and what we can add to a portfolio to insulate ourselves should some of those worst case scenarios happen.
Okay, so what about within equities? I mean, we've sort of touched on your concerns about Europe and its dependence on external demand, particularly China, I guess. And I'm not sure whether you're sort of painting a particularly bullish picture on that front. So that clearly there's a bit more value in that market, but are you sort of shying away from European equities in favour of quote unquote more defensive US equity strategy, or what other markets do you think look most appealing at this stage?
It's less of a geographic story for me at the moment. I do think the trade agenda is going to weigh on risk sentiment across geographies fairly equally, even if Asia, even if we do see a Chinese stimulus, I still think you're going to have all regions' assets, you know, struggle by a similar magnitude. For me, it's more about thinking within those geographies, what are the sectors or styles that tend to exhibit more defensive properties? So the clearest one for us is large cap rather than small, yeah, particularly here in the UK. Focusing on quality, so there we're thinking about companies with good free cash flow, good balance sheets. Certainly, given we've seen quite a rise in corporate debt, I think you're not going to want to find out that you're holding the stocks who have over-leveraged, even if interest rates are low. That still could be a problem if we're in a severe downturn scenario. So screening on quality, and then actually thinking about value as well, selectively, and not just on a broad basis, but thinking about, you know, areas of the value market, which when they've already to some degree discounted an adverse scenario, they tend to just not fall as much, history suggests, than you know, growth stocks. So for us, it's less about geographies and more about thinking about large cap value and quality.
Okay. I mean, there's a bit of controversy in there, isn't there? I mean, you know, the value growth debate, because maybe some growth stocks in a growth shock or disappointing growth environment, you know, you have better visibility of their earnings. But I mean, we have to concede that they're priced for a pretty good outcome.
Yeah, I think it's picking about. I think it's picking apart both the value basket and the growth basket, actually, and getting the best of both. So, you know, I think, for example,
which is where JP Morgan step in, obviously.
We have some expertise in this field. But, you know, I mean, let's take, for example, value in Europe. A good chunk of that is financials. Would we be advising at this stage with the ECB heading into deeper negative interest rates, you know, a clear buy on European financials? Not necessarily. However, there are other sections of the value basket, whether it's healthcare, et cetera, that, you know, we think would have those capital preservation properties. Similarly, within growth, I think, you know, you've got to be careful on a broad basis about high growth rates, but there are going to be tech stories, which are the disruptors that's long-term through the cycle, and you're going to want to have some of those as well. So, you know, whilst we say considering more value for the defensive properties, you've still got to be careful about what you're doing within those styles, I think.
Okay, and then, I mean, just before we get on to Brexit, we'll only discuss that briefly. I was just sort of thinking that, well, at Bruins, we've sort of laid out a relatively positive framework built upon avoiding a recession and central banks, you know, moving very swiftly and firmly to an accommodative position, and actually at a fiscal level, sort of not seeing any signs of austerity, you know, anywhere, you know, not least domestically. But we want to sort of challenge that and think about some of the risks. Now, I don't know whether you think I've painted a too aggressive bullish picture there, and you maybe want to pick that apart. But I mean, some of the risks to the thesis, of course, we talked about trade, but I don't know if there's any other sort of tail risks that are perhaps less discussed in markets at the moment, perhaps the issues that are going on in Turkey, or we also point to perhaps the US presidential election cycle and the candidates that may come to the fore on the Democrat side who perhaps have some less market-friendly policies. Perhaps we could discuss that one. I don't know if you've been spending any time.
Which is unfortunately probably going to take us into Brexit. Right. But no, I think that's exactly right, that what worries me is we're seeing across the West this polarization of politics to hard right and hard left. Questions as to why that is the case, the role of inequality, etc. But either way, we're seeing more extreme politics. And I think we have to, from that environment, expect some extreme or extraordinary policies. And as I say, when we're thinking through risks and tail risks, sort of surprising political occurrences and therefore surprising political policies, I think is something we absolutely need to think through and what would insulate our portfolios. So, you know, I think as we move towards the presidential election next year, exactly who the Democrat candidate is and quite how left, extreme left, some of those policies are and whether that rattles markets, I think is definitely one concern. Across Europe, you know, we've had, I would say, some good progress on the political front this year, and the recent appointment of Christine Lagarde, I think, has provided a lot of comfort at the helm of the ECB. But nevertheless, you know, we've still got, you know, Macron under pressure domestically, Merkel and the new, what will be the new formation of power within Germany, and again, some of the sort of more nationalist tendencies you're getting across Europe. So I think thinking through some of those political risks are the things that are at the forefront here. And then within the emerging world, you know, we've talked a lot about China, but there are still some very concerning things happening in the political spectrum in Turkey, for example. And so I think, you know, there's certainly going to be enough to keep us busy, even if that's the core scenario.
Okay, well, let's conclude on Brexit. I'd just be interested to know for our listeners, in your previous role, was that working for Philip Hammond?
Yeah, I was his economic advisor.
And so did you help sort of formulate those scenario analysis, which range from bad to very bad on the Brexit?
No. So that was done under George Osborne, ahead of the referendum. So I was working with Philip on a post-referendum, you know, what was the right fiscal strategy? What was, you know, the Treasury's thinking on Brexit? So no, I was post that analysis.
Okay, right. And so, what's going to happen? No, let's. I'll try and nail down the question a bit better than that. I mean, are we thinking that a No Deal Brexit is very difficult to materialise, and given the sort of makeup of given the parliamentary math, but that political risks will sort of still prevail that prevent sort of this value, this cheapness in sterling sort of materialising? Or do you have anything that's, do you have a more of a bearish view on the pound or something more bullish, perhaps?
I'm afraid nothing more bullish. So those of us stepping off on our summer holidays are going to find them pretty expensive, I think that's for sure. The main thing to remember is that this is not parliamentary theatre. Parliament represents the UK population, which is as polarised as it was 3 years ago on what it wants from Brexit. So on my website, if you go to our On the Mind section of our website, you know, there's some data and some charts here, which just from 4 weeks ago, there was a survey asking the UK population, what do you want from Brexit? 30% of the population said no deal. 35% of the population said a new vote and remain. So, you know, we are just as polarised as we always were on what we want our future relationship to be. And that is what Parliament represents. It represents still this total disagreement within the UK about exactly not only whether we should leave, but on what terms. You know, my six-year-old said to me, what is Brexit? And I said, well, basically, we used to be best friends with Europe, and now we're trying to decide whether we never want to speak to them again or still play with them at lunchtime, which I thought was me trying to just get through the conversation. But actually, I think it works. You know, we just can't decide how close we want to maintain those ties. So the problem is all on our side. So how do we move forward? Well, you know, Parliament at the moment, representing the UK population, has demonstrated on a number of occasions it has both the ability and willingness to stop No deal. So I think for the new Prime Minister, whoever that is, they would need a clear mandate from the population, which would change the arithmetic of Parliament. So it could be that the new leader says to the UK population, you know, we should feel confident and we should have no deal. And maybe the UK population and all those that want to remain change their mind. And, you know, the Conservatives have a landslide sweep, which changes that arithmetic. And then we could be looking at no deal. But under the current parliamentary arithmetic, which I think is coming from still a deep-rooted division in the population, then I don't think no deal is the most likely scenario. I am concerned about a general election and a surprise outcome, should we say, because the way in which, because of this population divide, you know, that is leading to obviously the rise of the Brexit Party on one side, but at the same time the rise of the Lib Dems on the other side, And I think predicting the outcome of any general election right now is very difficult, because you're going to have people voting for their Brexit outcome rather than necessarily a normal political persuasion. So you could have a traditional Conservative voter voting for the Labour Party purely because they are offering a Brexit outcome that the Conservatives aren't. So I'm and our first past the post system means that sort of political surprise, there's more risk of that. So coming back to your question, Sterling, you know, would I particularly advocate that we're going to have higher sterling near term? No, I think it's going to stay very noisy as we run up to October 31st. I think there will be a lot of saber rattling, which is going to keep international investors very concerned. Ultimately, I think we get there in terms of, I personally have always felt we're going to end up in a customs union for goods, because we control the money, we control free flow of people. The thing we concede on is accepting EU rules on goods, but whoever we trade with, we're going to accept regulations on goods. If we have a trading relationship with the US, we're going to accept US agricultural standards. So I sort of think that's the compromise that will come. But I have to say, 2 years ago, I had more conviction that that would be happening imminently, and
like
I've sort of
Brexit.
Lost faith.
And the Labour Brexit, they don't want to support that.
In how quickly we get there. Well, you know, who knows how quickly we get there. But as I say, right now, purely because of our political system and the fact we are going to have people voting in ways they haven't done before, I think the risk of waking up one morning and thinking, wow, I did not expect that outcome is quite high. And for that reason, I think sterling exposure is remains tricky at the moment.
Okay, well, that was a really, really neat summary. It's quite a complex subject, and you know, we've heard lots and lots about it, but that was a really great summary. Lots of questions I could pose to you there, but we won't. In fact, we did a podcast last week with Hanbury, political strategist, if people want to have a 25-minute to listen to, just a purely Brexit conversation. But we'll wrap that part of the conversation up. And just to conclude, I mean, I know you talked about the within equity markets, your style preferences, but if we're thinking across sort of asset classes, I mean, are you favouring equities? Are you favouring sovereign bonds? Are you favouring the dollar or EM currencies? Just some parts of the capital markets that you sort of see as offering the best opportunities, notwithstanding, you know, you're all about constructing portfolios, but which of those asset classes or currencies look the most appealing on a relative basis to you?
I think on a short-term basis, remaining relatively neutral in this environment where there's still a lot of risk seems the right thing to do. So, you know, maintaining exposure to equities, but in a slightly more defensive way. On a long-term basis, I'm a tremendous EM bull. I believe the rising middle classes in India and China is a story that, regardless of the trade war, is not going to be hindered. And we will see, not only as those economies emerge, but as their financial systems develop, our ability to actually invest in that story, I think, is changing in a really exciting way. So whether that's the, you know, China onshore market or China Bond Connect, you know, some of these developments that's happening in the emerging markets. So, you know, on a longer term horizon, and if you can weather the volatility, then I certainly think EM. I do think the alternative space in real assets is worth thinking about, particularly if, like me, you're a little concerned that some of the extraordinary policy that I talked about earlier does end up with a little bit more inflation risk, than thinking about some inflation risk to your portfolio at the moment, given at the moment inflation protection is fairly cheap because everyone's all focused on downturn and deflation. So I'd say on a longer term themes, but at the moment, you know, given there are these sort of political risks, despite the fact that the central banks are willing to cut rates, I'd say, you know, not sticking your neck out and hugging relatively neutral benchmarks at the moment looks appropriate.
Okay. Well, a really fascinating conversation. If a little on the, not on the fence, but a neutral position at the moment. That's you know, that's appropriate. No, that's the message in the short term. You know, we're delighted to have you back on the podcast. But if people want to hear more from you, they just sort of explore the JP Morgan website, do they?
Or... If you go to jpmorgan.am/Karen, you'll get to the Market Insights program, all of the stuff that we produce. the On the Minds of Investors series, which is where we answer the top questions we're getting from our clients. So that includes things like, should we worry about flattening yield curve? How will Brexit conclude? Yeah. If you want my full thoughts on Brexit, as well as, you know, are emerging markets worth the volatility, that kind of thing. So yeah, do take a look at that website.
Okay, great. Well, as I said, thanks again, Karen. And thanks to our listeners for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing #BrewinPodcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But until next time, many thanks for listening.